Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
JBR Capital has sponsored the Intercooler podcast for several months now. You've probably heard me talk about the company before. In that time, I've come to really understand what it is that makes JBR Capital different to other car finance companies. If I had to boil it down to one thing, I'd say it's this. Car finance is all JBR Capital does. Might sound like a minor detail, that, but in fact, it's really important. It means JBR Capital has a profound understanding of the car marketplace and of car buyers, an understanding that other finance companies could only hope to have. In fact, that very focused approach is exactly why the company was started in the first place. We recently had Darren Selig, founder of JBR Capital, on the podcast, episode 106, if you want to go back and listen. And he explained that he started the company when he realized that general finance lenders actually didn't understand cars or car buyers particularly well at all. So he spotted that gap in the market and he founded JBR Capital to fill it. So before you buy your next car, be it a supercar, sports car, classic car, a hypercar, or a luxury car, even if it's a brand new car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. And it really helps us if you tell them that the Intercooler sent you. JBR Capital is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority.
Welcome to the Intercooler podcast.
Welcome to episode 116 of the podcast, everybody. Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel with you here. And you join us after we've both spent a weekend at festivals, although very different festivals. Andrew was at the Goodwood Festival of Speed. I was at Glastonbury Festival. You don't need to hear about my time at Glastonbury, but we will talk a little bit about the Festival of Speed, because I was, even though I was at Glastonbury, I was just on my phone half the time looking at all the amazing things that were going on at the Festival of Speed. So we will talk about some of that stuff, some of Andrew's experiences. Actually, it's a busy episode. We've got plenty of other bits and pieces to get through. First of all, though, I just want to tell you all about some news around our website. I think you've probably heard us talking about our website before, our shiny new website, which looks really beautiful. And we now have a launch date, Wednesday, the 6th of July, next week. So it's really quite soon. If you go to the-intercooler.com, you'll see a holding page, which gives you some idea of what the website might look like. You can also sign up for updates about the launch, and we will tell you much, much more about it in next week's episode. Andrew, just a quick word on the website, though, because we're excited. We've been putting an awful lot of work into this.
We've got, you probably know how many hundreds of stories we've already got uploaded to it. I know it's over 1 million words.
Yeah.
You know, not just from, you know, the likes of you and me, but from, you know, some of the greatest writers who've ever written about cars. You know, from people like, I don't know, Mel Nichols and Peter Robinson, who we grew up with, you know, to guys like Henry Catchpole and Andrew English and Colin Goodwin, you know, our engineers like David Tuig, Joe Fidalgo, our designers, Ian Callum, Julian Thompson. I mean, it's just an amazing roll call of the good and the great of the motor industry. And If you've subscribed to our app, you will be very used to reading the words of these people. But with the website, it's just going to be so much more accessible, so much easier to share, so much more beautiful, because you'll be able to look at it on in big screen glory. We are incredibly excited about it. This has always been in the pipeline. It's taken time because we wanted to get it right. What it's not going to be is one of these websites which is just bombarding you with clickbait and pop-ups and banners and everything else. It's going to be very, very clean, very simple, very beautiful. We are unbelievably excited about it. We've been working on it for, goodness knows how long we've been working on it for. Months and months and months. But it's kind of good to go now. And we're now just sort of going through the snagging phase where we are testing it to make sure it doesn't sort of fall over when we launch it. And that's next Wednesday, the 6th of July. So please do go and have a look. the-intercooler.com.
Yeah, that's the holding page for now, but you can sign up for email updates. there you go. So we'll tell you much more about the website next week. As we prepare to launch the real thing, it will be our new home. The app will live on, but the website will be our new home. So it's really important to us. Okay, more next week, but let's talk a little bit now about Goodwood Festival of Speed. I don't miss too many festivals of speed, I was disappointed to miss this one. It looked like a good one.
It was a bad one to miss, it was a really good festival. I mean, there was an amazing atmosphere. It was so busy. Everybody's walking around. Even on Thursday, people were going, this feels like a sort of a Saturday crowd. And by the time we got to Saturday, the place was absolutely rammed, which was great, wasn't it? And the stuff going on the hill. Oh, my God. I don't know where you want to stop. But, the amount of times I just had to stop what I was doing and just gasp at what was going on. There are a couple of cars, one van, which we need to have a quick chat about. I think the sort of, if there was one takeaway from it, if you want to go really, really, really fast up that hill, and, some people won't like this, but I think you need an EV. If you have an EV, its ability to deploy, which is what it's all about, you think that, until this weekend, and we'll get on to that in a minute, that the hill record was held by an EV, the Volkswagen IDR, and that how even that was smashed this weekend. It's what you need. And it was, to watch those things go up the hill was absolutely astonishing.
Mm. Yeah, it's a good point to ship out EVs. I suppose they're just well suited to these short burst forms of motorsport, aren't they? Because you get phenomenal power from... If you look at the motors that power these things, if you picked one up, the point is you'd probably be able to pick one up because they don't weigh anything like what a comparatively powerful combustion engine weighs. Also, because they're running over short distances, they don't need enormous battery packs, so they're not hideously heavy. And that's why they're able to go so damn quick.
Yeah, and you could also configure them because, they lead, the McMurtry, which we're going to talk about very shortly, that needed to have power for 40 seconds. So there's no trying to get any range. Range is an irrelevance. It's 1.1 miles. You need 1.2 miles of range. That's it. Because you can coast back down the hill. you can just turn everything up to 11 and let it go. And my goodness, they did.
Okay, let's come back onto the McMurtry in a moment. But you did mention the Ford Supervan.
The Transit. That was hilarious.
I'm sure people are familiar, but can you give us a couple of minutes on the backstory of Supervan and why it's...
Very quickly, there have been there have been other Supervans. The XJ220 Mule was a super, was a Ford Transit because it didn't want anyone to know what powertrain was in it. And Renault did a Renault Espace with Formula One power, but the Supervans you're talking about are official sort of Ford products. The first one was in 1971, which was just an old would have normally been powered by a V4 engine Transit, into which they put a GT40 engine. It wasn't a GT40 with a Transit body. People always say that it wasn't, but it did have the powertrain of a GT40. And that looked ridiculous. If you go and put Supervan into YouTube, go and watch that thing being driven around. It is utterly absurd. Most of the time it spends on three wheels, sometimes two. It looked like a nightmare to drive. And then in 84, they did a proper one with, you know, it didn't actually have a steel transit body. It had like a silhouette body. And that ran with a Ford Cosworth DFL engine in it, I think. And that was properly rapid. And that in the early 90s, they actually adapted that car into Supervan 3, which had a Ford HB Formula 1 engine in it. And they were really, really rapid things. I mean, they would do, I think one of them did 175 miles an hour into the braking area of Stowe. But all those three Supervans put together don't have the power that this one Supervan that Ford unveiled at Goodwood has. 2,000 horsepower. And they got Romain Dumas, until this weekend, the previous Hill record holder, the Pikes Peak record holder, you know, Le Mans winner, all-round hero, to drive this thing. And it just looked absolutely ridiculous. I mean, actually, when he was trying to go fast, it looked amazing. But sometimes he wasn't trying to go fast. He was just trying to do a spectacle. And you can do this thing, this line lock thing, where you can... And actually, in the Supervan, you can lock either axle. So you can lock the front wheels and let the rear wheels rear tyres incinerate themselves, or vice versa. And to see a transit van sitting on the starting line disappear in its own tyre smoke before cannoning up the hill, it was... Yeah, that was a proper crowd pleaser. So, yeah, I mean, fair play to Ford for doing it. And also, I was talking to some of the guys from Ford, and they were going, oh, well, yeah, it's a bit of a pity because it hasn't actually got the full 2,000 horsepower this weekend. We couldn't quite get it, so it's probably only running about 1,700. And it hasn't got brake regen on it this weekend, because if it had, you know, it'd be able to go even faster. But it was still something like the fourth or fifth quickest thing up the hill all weekend. It's a two-ton transit van. so, yeah, loved seeing that.
There's a theme here, isn't there, with the two cars that we've been talking about. Is this when electric becomes cool with the Goodwood Festival of Speed audience? You know, with these two cars sort of demonstrate what can be done. And there will be people going, I don't care, it's not got a big V8 or a V12 or something. Really matter. Yeah,
watch them. Okay, they don't sound great, but watch them. The visual spectacle. You can't watch the Supervan with Dumas driving it, go up the hill and go, that's not exciting. Mm. It just is. It's absolute. It's utterly thrilling. And that's before we even mentioned the McMurtry.
Okay, so yeah, let's talk about thrilling. A thrilling spectacle. And for me, the biggest news from the weekend was the McMurtry Spearling setting a new outright course record. And this is the little electric car that looks like the Batmobile, doesn't it? The sort of scaled down child's Batmobile, maybe. It's a really curious looking thing, a single seater with a roof. It's a rear drive car. It's got about 1,000 horsepower and it weighs less than 1,000 kilograms. The clever thing about it really is that it's a fan car, so it sucks itself to the ground. And at standstill, it can produce 2,000 kilograms of downforce. It doesn't need the air flowing over any aero devices, the fan just draws it into the ground, which is
so. And what is so bizarre. Clever about that is, well, there are two things which are unbelievably clever about that. One is, you know, always with downforce you get drag. That is the eternal trade-off, isn't it? Not this time. You get no drag. And so it doesn't slow down as the speeds increases. It just goes on, you know, but the acceleration curve apparently is basically a straight line until they cap it at 200 miles an hour. And the other thing is, you've got 2 tons of downforce at rest, which means you don't need four-wheel drive. I mean, that thing went off the line like a shell out of an artillery gun with rear-wheel drive, because it was already basically clamped to the ground. So it wasn't going anywhere. I mean, I think they were saying it did 0 to 60 in 1.2 seconds.
My God, was it 1.2?
1.2 or 1.5, but it was a low to mid ones. And I haven't done the maths, but the G you must have pulled. I mean, it's not far off. Well, it is a bit far off a top fuel dragster, which does 0 to 100 in under a second. But honestly, if you'd seen that thing go off the line. I mean, okay, let's just talk briefly about another electric car that was going up, only because I happened to be sat behind it on the hill, and I witnessed a bit. So this was the Porsche 718 Cayman E-Performance, which is a 1,000 horsepower electric Cayman. It's, you know, if you remember the Mission E concept, it's basically, it's the next development of that. Now, the 1,000 horsepower, and I happened to be sitting behind Richard Leitz when he went off the line. And I remember looking at it, and I remember saw the sort of lights go green. And the next time my brain registered anything, he was turning in for the first corner. He'd just gone. It had just disappeared. And that is nothing like as fast as the McMurtry. So, yeah.
Wow. I would love to have seen it in person, but the footage of that, the record-breaking run, it's on YouTube. It's bizarre. It looks like the footage has been sped up. The way it
does
carries speed through corners and accelerates, it's phenomenal.
That's what your eyes tell you. You think your eyes are deceiving you. I mean, I was standing just on sort of the main straight past the house when it came past, and as it came past, you know, something just didn't compute. It just didn't seem. It didn't seem possible that something. Okay, I mean, yeah. I mean, if this had been a supersonic aircraft coming past at 500 feet, then you know, fair enough. But something that's actually attached to the planet coming past you like that, so close, was. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, the closest I've ever seen to that level of visual drama. And okay, it's a very, very different thing. Because you can get so close to bikes on the Isle of Man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's that level of, I can't believe it, insanity.
God, yeah, I've seen the bikes at the Isle of Man coming through Bray Hill. It's, for spectacle, there's nothing quite like it. Yeah, that you compare the McMurtry to that speaks a lot. So, Max Chilton driving. Wow, huge credit to Max. He set a new outright record, 39.08 seconds. So, several tenths quicker than the VW IDR. And do you remember, for a long time, the Goodwood record was held by Nick Heidfeld in a Formula One car? Was it a McLaren?
41.6. It was a McLaren. Yes, it was. And he set it in 1999. Okay? So I think he held it for like 20 years.
Yeah.
And I think there was a certain thing in which thinking, well, you know, it may never fall. Because I know at the time it was so much faster than... But what I find so amazing about the McMurtry, you know, Volkswagen, you know, the largest car company in the world, goes and builds an electric hill climb car. And the very next year, this tiny little startup from absolutely nowhere, which no one's heard of, goes and beats it. Now, there are reasons for that. You know, I think one of the really smart things about the McMurtry is that it's so small, so narrow, whereas the IDR is a big old thing, isn't it? So you just don't take up so much space, which means you can take much better lines through corners. But even so, it was astonishing to see.
It went 2.5 seconds quicker than Heidfeld in that F1 car.
Yes.
Which is a huge gap. But as a proportion of the elapsed time, 40 seconds or so, 2.5 seconds in 40 seconds or so is a phenomenal amount. If you extrapolate that over a Grand Prix distance, you know, a qualifying lap in an F1 car.
Or a Nürburgring lap.
Yeah, yeah. If we're talking F1, you know, what, double that, double 40 seconds? Yeah, a minute and 20 seconds. That's about a qualifying lap, isn't it? The McMurtry would be 5 seconds. I'm not saying it would be 5 seconds quicker over a Formula One circuit, but to give you an idea, it's an enormous margin.
That's the margin of superiority.
Phenomenal. It's special to me, the McMurtry, because it comes from one town across from where I went to school. I went to school in Thornbury in South Gloucestershire. This is from just outside Charfield. And it just seems that bit more special to me because that's where I grew up. You know, that was home for me as a kid, where I went to school.
Yeah.
I really like it because of that. And we will be doing more with McMurtry. I think
we're going to
do
a lot on it because I just think there will be people, and I completely understand this, who, you know, who say, well, hang on, you know, they haven't said what it's going to cost, but we know it's going to be a 7-figure car, so it's going to be £1 million minimum. They'll make hardly any. They wouldn't tell me what their intended production was, but they said, you know, I said to them, you know, double digits, and they sort of looked at me as if to suggest, well, yes, but probably quite low double digits. But I don't know. These are people who strike me as people with plans, who have places to go. And I just think it's a really, really interesting project. And the very fact that they have, you know, we have spent this long on this podcast raving about an electric car, you know, is not something I thought I'd be doing anytime soon. So,
big volumes, you know, isn't it?
Good on them. Yeah.
Anything else from Goodwood? It's Glastonbury on the brain here. Anything else from Goodwood?
Well, I'm just going to do a minute on the stuff that I drove because, well, I can. And I just want to. So I drove only because I just feel so ridiculously lucky. And I kind of think if I put it on the record, then it somehow feels a bit more real to me. So I drove at the members' meeting, I was lucky enough to drive the 1987 Porsche 962 in the parade there. But they had the 1982 winner there, the 956, and being unable to drive two cars at once. I didn't drive that in the parade, but I did up the hill on Friday. The car that won Le Mans in 1982, the only race it ever did, which then got parked for the next 40 years. And there I was flinging it up the hill, which was lovely. It was such a friendly, nice, I mean, even easy car to drive. I then got out of that into a thing called the 961. Now, you've driven a 959. And the 961 is the one and only racing version of the 959 that ever got made. So imagine a 959 with half a ton less weight. And instead of 450 horsepower, 650 horsepower. It was ridiculous, actually. And it was actually really quite a hard car to drive. It didn't feel... whereas, you know, something like a 962 feels so developed and so together, this just felt like, you know, a wrestling match from start to finish. Enormous amounts of turbo lag, very difficult, even just to get it off the line. And then once it finally lit up, oh my goodness, watch out.
I think you've driven the 961 before, haven't you? And I think
that
you wouldn't be in a hurry to drive it again.
Yeah, well, you say that, there's somebody opposite you, and of course you do. I mean, it was hard. It was, you know, it was challenging. It was, you know, literally just to get it to the top of the hill because of all the lag and the banging about. And, you know, this is a car with no downforce. It's engined to completely the wrong base, a ridiculously short wheelbase. You could so easily bin it. So I drove that. And then I drove the GT. Remember the GT3R, the 997 GT3R hybrid? The only, you know, hybrid 911 that there's been. I drove that again. The hybrid had been taken out, so it was rear-wheel drive rather than four-wheel drive, and that was just beautiful. That's the sort of car you get in, and you actually feel you can have a bit of a go because it's quite compact. It's normally aspirated, so, you know, no lag to worry about. It's got paddles. It just makes your life easy. And actually, of the three, that's the one I enjoy driving most because... the other two, even the 956, which was lovely to drive, you just think of the history and the value and the everything else. It is intimidating. Whereas in the 997, I just felt completely at home. And you sort of start thinking, oh, well, I wonder where I could go faster if I were going to drive it again. And you can't think like that. You just got to get it to the top in one piece, which I did. But that was mega. So, yeah, lucky boy.
A good festival of speed. Okay, yep. Well, I'll be there next year.
Good.
Let's leave that there for now then, because I've been driving some new old Jaguars. And I'm not going to spill all the beans here because I'm going to be writing a couple of pieces for the Intercooler app and website, actually. But I just want to discuss a couple of bits and pieces here. So Jaguar invited me to Jaguar Land Rover Classic, which is where it's actually a separate business to JLR. And it's where they restore older Jaguars and Land Rovers and where they build continuation models. It's also where they store this incredible collection of heritage vehicles, just cars from the Jaguar and Land Rover back catalogues that are somehow significant. I'll come to that in a moment. But the instant you walk into the reception area at Jaguar Land Rover Classic, you realise that it's a special place, just littered with, to the right, loads of really special Jaguars, two XJ220s there, Mark IIs, all sorts of special bits and pieces, E-types, and then to the left, you've got a whole load of Land Rovers, you've got early Land Rovers, you've got early Range Rovers there, just really special, significant stuff, and that's the reception area.
But it's not open to the public, is it? It's not like a museum.
I I think probably, I don't know, I don't want to send a flood of people there just turning up, but it looks as though that reception area is geared up for guests. You know, there's
so you could probably go on an official tour or something.
I would have thought so. It's worth looking into. Even if you just stuck your nose into that place, you'd be impressed by what you saw. But we then went into the sort of production facility or the workshop, which is enormous and immaculate. And the capability that they have there is really significant. You know, they have XJ220s shipped from all over the world to that place to be serviced, in some instances by people who built the things originally. And, you know, there's just all sorts of wonderful cars being serviced or built or restored or built from scratch, as these continuation cars are. We then went into the the storage facility where these 400 heritage cars live, and they're stacked on two levels on these ramps, you know, one ramp above the other. And you're just walking through this enormous hall, spotting these incredibly significant cars. They recently found what is actually known to be the earliest surviving Land Rover. Okay, it's thought to be the earliest surviving Land Rover. It was found in a garden in Birmingham, buried in mud up to its axles, and it's now in this collection. They've got the Queen's L322 Range Rover, dark green Range Rover, which is one that she drove. And it's just sat there with the window down, and you can stick your head into it and go, Queen sat there, Queen drove this. It's bizarre. It's in pristine condition. And what else have they got? They've got cars from Bond films. So I think in No Time to Die, an original shape Range Rover comes in and hits Bond. I can't remember what he's driving. But that Range Rover is in that collection and it's destroyed at the front. They've got just all sorts of significant things there. The one that caught my eye was a yellow F-Type four-seater, which I had no idea existed.
Blimey.
Yeah.
You ought to ask Ian Callum about that.
Good point. Good point indeed. Yeah, we will. It's actually a 2+2. And apparently a couple of these things were built. And this one is a runner. It's a V8 rear drive. And you peer in through the window and you see these two actually tiny seats in the back. And you know why they did it, because the 911, so many people are able to have a 911 because they have those little rear seats, which are tiny. But if you've got kids, they're actually handy. And without them, you know, a 911 wouldn't be practical for so many 911 owners. And Jaguar clearly experimented
and also even people who don't have kids. Even if you never use them, it's not the same, because you think that, well, one day I might have to. Maybe there'll be some set of circumstances. Maybe it'll be somebody else's kid, or I'll find myself in some situation. And people who buy Range Rovers and never go off-road at them, or people buy Ferraris and never do 200 miles. It's not what you're going to use them for. It's the knowledge that should you do that they could. And, you know, I think that's a point that often gets missed. So... So was it on a longer wheelbase, or did it just not have a boot? Or
this is the thing, it's buried away towards the back of all these stacks of cars. I had to sort of squeeze my way past the Queen's Range Rover to try and get to it, and then it's packed in cheek by jowl with a load of other cars. So, and it's dark, a little dark corner, and so I was walking around this thing, you know, folding my way between all these other cars, just trying to figure out what they'd done. It's very difficult to tell. But apparently, it is a bit longer in the wheelbase, so there is more length in there. But when you look at the seats, they are tiny. And I think that's probably why the 2+2 F-Type didn't go any further, because actually, it probably wouldn't have made much of a difference to how practical the car was. I would love to drag it out of that collection and put it in open space, because I suspect they've done something with the glass house, with the rear of the cabin, just to draw it out a little bit, I guess to make a little bit more headroom in those rear seats. Because it there's something about it that doesn't look quite right, and I could not put my finger on it. I was staring at it right up until the moment where I got dragged away, just trying to figure out what they'd done. Do you know the four-seat E-Type with the much higher roof at the rear of the cabin?
Yeah, that was an official production model, the 2+2 E-Type, yeah.
And it looks much less much more ungainly than a normal E-Type coupe. This had a hint of that about it. I might be wrong, but I was staring at it thinking, that's something there towards the back of the cabin is not quite right. It might have just been me. But it was really intriguing to see this thing that I had no idea existed. And it's a runner, you know, the chap who runs the collection took it home one day. Apparently the fuel gauge works backwards, but it's a proper runner. So it's really a really intriguing car just to spy for a few minutes and try and figure out a little bit more about it.
Shall we make it our mission over the next week to have a word with Ian about it and then report back on it next week?
Good idea. We'll do that. I've asked them to take some photos of it for us. The Jaguar guys were a little bit coy about it. So it might be that they actually didn't want us to see it and reveal all about it. But we'll try. We'll ask the questions.
Good.
Because it's an intriguing thing. So that was the morning.
And you drove some stuff.
After that, we went to JLR's Fen End. It's sort of a proving ground, which used to be ProDrive's proving ground. It was just Kenilworth Airfield back then. I remember going there years ago to drive a couple of bits and pieces. It's now, they've spent so much money on this facility because it looks pristine. And it's basically a perimeter circuit around an old airfield. It's like a motorway that folds itself around an airfield. It's wide, it's three lanes wide like a motorway, with a banked corner around a hairpin at the far end. So it's not a racetrack, and there's no runoff whatsoever, you know, apart from the fact that it's wide. So it's a slightly odd place to drive a car, but yeah, we were there to drive the C-Type continuation, which is Jaguar Classic's most recent continuation. We were also there to drive the D-Type continuation that came before it. Sadly, though, that car had a mechanical fault. I think it was a brake fluid leak that they couldn't trace on the day, so that car was parked up. They tell us we'll be invited back to drive it at some point, which I hope to do. In its place, then, we had an XK120, and then we had a lightweight E-Type, which is, a recent continuation type thing, but also the E-Type Reborn, which is a fully restored E-Type. So we had these four cars to drive. I'm not going to spill everything here because I want to write a couple of stories about this occasion, but I do just want to talk about the C-Type, which is, they cost between 1 and 2 million. It's not entirely clear at the moment. No more than 16 to be built. Based on the 1953 model, the C-Type at Le Mans. So disc brakes and that extra air scoop in the bonnet. Honestly, it's a new car, but it's probably based on the oldest car I've ever come across. I don't think I've ever driven anything from earlier than 1953. It was so far outside of my wheelhouse, I can't even begin to express how alien this thing was to me. a totally bizarre experience. And I haven't driven many cars on cross-ply tyres either, or anything from this era. Bits and pieces, but not much. And just from the instant I got into it, I thought, this is unfamiliar territory. This is not what I'm used to at all. So my legs bunched up, knees bent on pedals that did not fall quite where I wanted them to. Steering wheel, a bit of a stretch away, and a big wheel with a tiny, thin little rim. And so I just sit in it, immediately feeling uncomfortable. And you've got this super sharp clutch. You've got a non-synchro gearbox, so you have to be careful with your upshifts. You have to double declutch on the way down. Again, alien territory for me.
It's interesting you say that, because it should. From second to first, the first gear should be the only gear without a without a synchro mesh on it. So you should have been able to, it would be quite a slow change, but you should have been able to just change normally on the others, unless they've put a race box or something else in it.
Yeah, well, it's a non-synchro box. I did ask. And they specifically say, please double the clutch on the way down. Okay, I'll do a little bit of digging on that. But that's certainly what they said.
Ultimately, it's what they call the Moss box, which is the same box that they put in, the XQ120 and... I think it even went into early E-types. But anyway, we digress.
Maybe they just wanted us to be careful with it.
Did you enjoy it?
No. Do you know, one of the issues with these events is that it's literally three laps of a... How long's the course? It might be a mile and a half. So it's just enough to get a taste.
So you get 5 minutes in the car.
Yeah, if you're lucky. And... What I found is that I start off horribly uncomfortable, just sort of wanting this experience to be over, because this thing's worth some seven-figure sum. I don't want to break it. And so I'm always just relieved when these experiences are over. However, after two laps, onto your third lap, you start getting comfortable. You realise that actually you can do this double D-clutch thing. You realise the brakes are pretty reliable and strong. You can lean on them. You realise these cross-ply tyres somehow do produce a whole load of grip. You realise that it's not going to try and spit you off this car. And so you start leaning into it a little bit more, and then you get pulled in. So that's the frustration. You just want to spend a morning howling around in it to try and get your head around it. But the bit that really stood out was not when I was driving at all, but when I was in the other seat with... the chap's name, I think, is Stephen Hollis, and he's a racing driver, but also Jaguar Land Rover's lead development driver. So he's the bloke who sets these things up. He's probably about as familiar with them as anybody. My God, that was an experience. Honestly, to witness firsthand how these things can be driven. The first time he came honking into a corner, a quick left-hander, and he just kept on the power and didn't break into the last instant. I thought, oh, there we go. We're into that barrier then, aren't we? And of course, he stands on the brakes. The thing goes on its nose, sheds a load of speed, and then it just turns in. And I could not believe how quickly it would turn into a corner. He also sat super low in this thing, so you're barely looking over the bonnet. And as he's accelerating, the prow rises like a boat. So you really can't see a thing, which just makes you feel... all the more discombobulated. But when he chucks it into a corner, it just immediately starts drifting in that 50s racing car cross-ply tyre way. And he's just got it balanced like that, just with the steering, constant inputs and corrections, and the thing's just gliding through a corner. And that is perhaps the most balletic thing you can see, you will ever witness in motorsport, particularly at places like Goodwood, when you've got a whole load of them, drifting, four-wheel drifting through corners. And I realised that is the type of driving I want to be capable of.
I mean, when I heard you were going to go and do this job, I was really excited because, as people will know, I'm reasonably familiar with cars from that era, and I know how they drive and I know how to drive them. And it frustrates me to hear you speak like this because, you can't, particularly if you've never been exposed to that kind of car before, you cannot expect to have anything other than, frankly, a negative experience of it if they only let you have 5 minutes at it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And I think, frankly, it's a compliment to you that even in that time you started to feel that you were starting to get into it. But I just hope they, when they invite you back, even if you'd had 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. What you would have seen, and I'm sure this bloke who drove you was absolutely superb, and there are many people who drive those cars incredibly well. But what you can't divine from the passenger seat is how much of that is the skill of the driver, and how much is the simple fact that that's the car, the way the car is designed to be driven. That's what it wants to do. It's like a modern racing car, which if you drive it slowly and the tyres are cold and the brakes are cold and everything, and it's just horrible, and then suddenly. And you would have done this. It warms up a bit. You get some tyre, and then suddenly it just becomes easier. And that's the thing that you would have found, is actually they are in many ways easier to drive when they're sliding than when they're not, because that's what they're designed to do. And that's when you get into that sort of bit which you experience from the passenger seat, where they're drifting, which makes me all go sort of, you know, gooey at the knees, because that's what I love. I mean, to me, that is a state of grace which you can get into in a car, which you just don't get in modern cars. And that's why I love them so much. And it just frustrates me that you didn't get to experience that. And, you know, I know you well enough and, you know, for long enough, I know how good a driver you are. I know that once you realise just how easy and wonderful and controllable and adjustable these cars are on the limit, when they have got a slip angle, I think you'd find a kind of automotive heaven that, you know, you haven't found yet. So, we'll find a way of doing it.
I came away just thinking, I have to spend more time in these cars. And what the Stephen said to me is that because they're cross-plies, they're so progressive. And so once you've got the confidence to carry in enough speed and get it to that point, it's super controllable. And I know I could control it in that moment, because I've driven plenty of cars, drifting sideways, whatever. I just need the time to build up my confidence and get to that point. And I couldn't.
But also, the other thing is, you don't need a £2 million C-type to do it. You know, I mean, I've talked about it before in this podcast, you know, 1960s Alphas, you know, a Giulia TI saloon, you know, an Italian police car, sit up and bake, three box saloon, is absolutely as good, possibly better at drifting than a C-type. Yeah?
Yeah.
And
well, there you go.
Without the consequences and without the risk and the jeopardy. So, yeah, I mean, well, we'll find a way.
It's just, it's massively unfamiliar to me, and that's what really stood out. So, the ergonomics of the thing I found immediately off-putting, but I think with more time I'd get used to that. And B, you know, I've driven plenty of racing cars, and I'm used to grip, I'm used to precision, I'm used to that feeling of slick tires biting into the ground and leaning on that grip as hard as you can. That I can do that, you know, but I'm just so unfamiliar with this feeling of a car constantly sliding beneath you and having the confidence to get to a point where it starts doing that. But I'm determined to get there, because I think it looks so graceful and so enjoyable, and it's absolutely what I want to be able to do in a car.
And it's easy, honestly. I can do it, so it must be.
No, not at all, but I just need more wheel time. The last thing I'll say is that so the other cars we drove, the two E-types, particularly the lightweight, so it's based on a design that's only 10 years or so younger, but the leap that Jaguar made in that time, excuse the pun, I could not get my head around that, particularly from an ergonomics point of view. You know, I sat in the E-Type, legs outstretched, the small steering wheel. Is it a Motolita steering wheel?
Yeah, Motolita it will be, yeah.
Yeah, and leather trimmed, one that I could actually grip. And with a gear shift that was right where I wanted it, and this certainly had synchro, so I could just use it like a normal box.
Yeah, because that would be a Jaguar box, which they replaced the Moss box with. Yeah.
Okay. So I could.
But if you think about what happened in those 10 years, you compare us. So they've actually still got essentially variants of the same engine in them, but So C type space frame, E type monocoque, C type live rear axle, E type independent rear axle. C-type iron block carburetors, E-type alloy block fuel injection. I mean, it was just totally different. And Jaguar learned so much. And you know, they say that racing improves the breed. I mean, I don't think you'll ever get a better example of it than that, than the progression from, you know. And they were both road car derivatives. I mean, the C-type was derived from the XK120, and the racing E-type you drove was obviously an E-type. But the progress, as you say, that was made, it doesn't feel like it was exactly, well, almost maybe even a bit less than 10 years. Night and day, I'm sure.
Honestly, it really blew my mind. And it meant that I could drive the lightweight E-Type the way I drive. You know, it had more grip. I just felt comfortable in it. Ergonomically, it was a world apart. And so I just felt much more confident in this thing howling around. And it was brilliant. So I'll say much, much more about these cars in one or two articles to come on the Intercooler soon. Also, the tour of that classic, their heritage collection at JLR Classic, we'll have some good photos from that as well. I'll write that as a separate piece because it was such a privilege to get to see it. But, you know, the main thing for me is that I'm so unfamiliar with older racing cars, and I just, one way or another, I have to find a way to become more familiar with them because that is the type of driving that I'd like to do. Do you know what? The frustration was that the D-Type wasn't available that day, and I hope I get to go and drive it because I suspect, even from C-Type to D-Type, I would be aware of a huge amount of progress and
you would,
just feel more comfortable.
Yeah, you would. I mean, a D-Type is probably not as easy as a C-Type to hoon around, but actually I think you'd feel more familiar with it just because it's a bit stiffer and it's a dedicated, it's a purpose-built race car, whereas the C-Type was an adapted road car, and yeah, it would be interesting. Well, you know, so they need to get you back and they need to give you some proper amount of wheel time. 5 minutes is ridiculous.
Yes, please, Jaguar. Thank you. Okay. All right, well, we're recording this at the start of British Grand Prix week. We're not going to do loads, but I mean, it's always a highlight of the year, isn't it? I love watching F1 cars race at Silverstone. Sadly, I couldn't be there. I did get invited at least to the Saturday for qualifying. I couldn't go, but looking forward to the weekend nonetheless. Hopefully, we're going to see a bit more competition at the front end. It seems as though there's a lot of talk, isn't there, that the Mercedes is going to be better suited to Silverstone than it has been the last few tracks we've been at. It's funny, you know. Here I am, hoping that maybe the Mercedes is going to be competitive. And yet, we know, don't we, that Leclerc in that Ferrari is probably the quickest over a single lap. We know that Max in that Red Bull is the quickest over a race distance. That's probably going to be borne out. And yet here I am excited for the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, Silverstone, it's a curious place. I mean, I'm afraid they sell it out every year, which is fantastic, but it's not actually the greatest spectator circuit out there. There are other places, you know, in the UK you can go and watch motor racing, which from a spectator's point of view will give you, you know, a bigger, greater, better view of what's going on. On the telly, it's amazing. But what I love, I mean, I think that Silverstone is, it's an amazing circuit for something that's developed from, you know, an airfield, and it's got all the history and everything else. But if you think about what a car needs, you know, it's not like you can just say, well, it's a pure aero circuit, or it's a pure power circuit, or it's a, you know, it's a tight twist. It really does have everything, because we think of it, don't we, as a sort of, you know, a fast circuit with high speed corners, and it's got plenty of those. But actually, if you think about the nadgy little bits they've built onto the new circuit, sort of turn, whatever it is, turns 3 and 4, you think about Loughfield, you think about that very sharp left into what is now Club Corner. You know, you need, your car needs to be, you know, a consummate all-rounder to do well there. And I think, yeah, I mean, I would, you know what I'd love? I'd love it to be George's race. That would make me so happy for George Russell to, you know, come from nowhere and blitz the British Grand Prix, you know, like Lewis did in 2008. That would be, but I don't see it happening, I'm afraid. I see it as a straight fight between Max and Charles. I mean, the thing about Mercedes is, you know, they are getting better, but they're still the third best team. And I don't think, you know, if you're the third best team, what we are saying is that the best you can do on your own merit, rather than relying on bad stuff to happen to cars in front of you, has come fifth. Yeah? So, they, you know, they can make a huge improvement, but, you know, unless one of the Ferrari Red Bull drivers, you know, breaks down or trips over themselves or whatever, you're still coming fifth, which, you know, isn't going to keep you anywhere near the title hunt. I mean, I think that's probably already gone anyway. So, you know, what I'm really, really hoping that because it's smoother, they say they've sorted out the porpoising issue. They say that's in the past. But the bouncing, because the car is incredibly stiff over bumps and curbs, is still a proper problem for them. But Silverstone, as we know, is wide and open and smooth and flattened. If it, let's put it this way, if it can't go quick there, you do wonder where it is going to go quick. So I've got everything. I mean, you know, for me, Lewis has, I don't know, I can't remember how many British Grand Prix Lewis has won, 5, 6, 7, something like that. I just love George to do really, really well there. But I think ultimately it'll be a Red Bull Ferrari fight.
I suspect so. Bring it on, though. Looking forward to it. We'll leave it there. We've got a really good listener question coming up.
Oh, good.
But before... Yeah, I've not told you what it is, but you'll have a good answer. Before we do that, JBR Capital, thank you for coming on board as sponsor. If you're looking to buy a new car or a used car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. Contact details in the description of this podcast. Please also rate and review the podcast. And wherever you listen to us or watch us, follow or subscribe. That's how we find a bigger audience. So please do that. So the listener question, I've got it on my phone here.
And it Why comes do these from, things always get make me nervous?
But it shouldn't.
I'm not sure I like things having been bounced on me.
So this comes from Dan Rickard. Thank you, Dan. And this is in response to last week's episode where we talk about the McLaren Artura. And we spent a couple of minutes talking about the new powertrain and how wonderful it is that you get full torque from 2,000 RPM.
2,250.
Yeah, which is half what you the
less
torque
than half,
peak
yeah.
from the V8 McLarens.
Yeah, that's 5,000.
Yeah, so it's night and day. And he says, the hybrid system and the new turbos gives the McLaren more low down torque, so it's not as peaky as the 5,000 RPM peak torque on the old V8. Is this what we really want in our sports cars? He's suggesting that in something like a mid-engine supercar, he doesn't mind a higher torque peak. He says he's quite happy holding an engine up in the upper reaches, getting down the gears when necessary, keeping an engine on the boil. Why is it a good thing that you've got all this torque from so low down in the rev range? Is that actually what you want in this sort of car?
Wow, I could do an entire podcast on this. Well, I mean, in many ways, he's got a point. He absolutely has a point. If you're ringing it out and you're really driving these things, it doesn't matter if it's all up the top because that's where you're going to be anyway. So that's fine. The other thing is that torque peaks are so misleading because what they don't describe at all is the shape of the torque curve. So you could have, I'm going to be ridiculous here, but you could have 99% of your torque at 1,000 revs, rising to 100% at 5,000 revs, and somebody will say it was a really peaky engine because it doesn't develop maximum torque until 5,000 revs. It's insane. It's ridiculous. So you've got to have a look at the torque curve, but these are things which manufacturers very rarely supply. So that's two things. The thing that I would say is that in more normal driving, when you're not, particularly with things like, you know, McLarens and enormous performance potential, you're not actually, because you're never on the right roads and there's always too much traffic about you, you're actually very rarely really ringing them out. You're probably going to do it most often on a track. But quite often what you do need is just instant response to squirt past the line of traffic. Or you're driving the car in a sort of fast road condition where you're not using all the revs, but you want to be getting on with it. And at times like that, maybe you don't want to be going hunting around for torque, and maybe if an opportunity presents itself to get past something, you do just want an instant squirt of power. And that is when having a good chunk of low-down torque is really helpful. I think, however, I think where he absolutely has a point is I think it's less characterful. You know, we think of the sort of, you know, small capacity, high output, naturally aspirated engines, and the way they build, that sort of sense of coming onto the cam. And the, I mean, and we love all that. And one of the things that, and I actually met to, I spoke to McLaren about this, and they sort of nodded sagely, is that one of the things that Ferrari does very well with its turbo engines is that they artificially manage torque curves to make those engines respond more like naturally aspirated engines. And, you know, and they do it according, you know, not just to the drive mode that you're in or the revs that you're pulling, but even to the gear that you're in. You'll get different maps per gear. And they will artificially restrict torque at lower revs so that you do get this crescendo, you do get this increasing sense of urgency, building and building and building. So I think, frankly, there's a middle ground between something where you get, you know, a wall of torque and a completely horizontal torque curve from whatever it is, 2,000 to 5,000 revs, on the one hand, on the other hand, having a sort of properly peaky engine, which doesn't actually allow you to do to access the performance of the car very easily. And I think that the Artura, does that well. I'd certainly prefer that to, because it's just more usable than a really peaky engine. But I think that there is a middle ground, and I think that McLaren would probably be well served by having a look, a bit of a fiddle with its torque curves and coming up with something which is, you know, a bit more top ND, but not quite as far as they were with the old V8. Sorry, short question, long answer.
And I guess the real benefit of the hybrid system and the torque fill is that transient throttle response. So those old peakier McLaren engines didn't have the sharpest throttle response. And I haven't driven the Artura, but presumably with this, with that torque fill, snappier turbos, you get that sharper throttle response the moment.
It just goes. Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you, Dan, for your question. Thank you all for listening, and we'll do it again next week.
Yep. Bye.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.